Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 17th of December 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This episode is actually pre-recorded and it is episode 23 in our series here where we look at ancient civilizations and the connections to the white race and all the other parts to do with ethnology that get ignored by the mainstream. And of course I have with me today my co-host from the patriotic arts community, the Patriarch. Patriarch, how are you doing? What's life like for you?
Very well, thanks. Life's good. Just waiting for Christmas now, I guess, and it's always a busy time of year. I've got so many birthdays. And I added to that list an anniversary last year, so my anniversary is on Friday. So December is one of the busiest months for me and the most expensive. So I'm kind of looking forward to it, but at the same time, I'm not.
Well, happy anniversary to you for that. That's great news. Yeah, I have a busy month through December as well. And just to let listeners know, we will have plenty of new content for you on over Christmas. We are pre-recording Radio Albion Roundtables. We are pre-recording Patriotic History. There will probably be some Albion narrations on over the Christmas week instead of the Daily Nationalist. But there will be lots of new content for you anyway, so do keep tuned in to Radio Albion. Well, in the last episode of Patriotic History, we talked about the Book of Esther, and I thought I would have a brief look at that again before we really get into this episode. And I found a good quote which really sort of describes the issue with it. The lack of a religious perspective almost prevented the Book of Esther from being included with the canonical books, and is the reason it is widely thought why Esther is the only book of the Old Testament that was not found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Greek editions add prophetic dreams and prayers to heaven that serve to reintroduce the religious aspect. And that bit there is talking about Flavius Josephus' version. It adds more religiosity to it. But the fact that the book was not found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls says that the people that compiled those scrolls did not consider it to be canonical. And the people that compiled those scrolls were the nationalist Israelites. They were the ethno-nationalists amongst them. The Pharisees and the Sadducees, they were Judeans. They included Edomites and proselytes of the gate. And the Essenes rejected all of that. And they said, no, we are going to stick with the law and only the law. Mm-hmm. So they were ethno-nationalists and they rejected the book. So
yeah. I would say that you want to go as close to the source as possible, right, to know if these books were legitimate or not. I mean, if they're not regarded as legitimate, worthy of preserving in hidden caves for centuries, not thousands of years, how a church, thousands of years later is going to have the correct canon version or understanding of what should be included and what not is not as likely, is it?
No, that's a very good point. And the original source material would be the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they did not include this book. And also, a part of the book itself is this concept of Purim, which is this modern Jewish festival where they create cakes in the shape of somebody's ears, and they eat them, and they get blind drunk and do extreme things. None of this is sanctioned in the Old Testament. And Purim itself is not a holiday sanctioned by Moses. And the Israelites were told not to make new festivals other than the ones that they were given. So this aspect of the book also casts doubt on it being a genuinely inspired book, because the people in the book who are described as Jews in the book, they are going against the laws that were given to Moses and the Israelites. So perhaps the book was included as an early warning about the people who would later become known as the Jews. Mm. I mean, Josephus tells us that this term did not come into use until after the remnant of Judah had returned from Babylon to Judea, and that it referred to citizens of Judea rather than descendants of Judah. And yet the book itself is supposed to be referring to something that happened to these Judeans that were actually in Babylon. And when they were in Babylon, that was prior to the country itself being known as Judea, and prior to people that were citizens of it being known as Judeans or Jews. So again, there's this incongruous a bit there. But I do recommend people read the Josephus version anyway.
Yeah. And another thing to note is actually before the King James Bible in the 16th century, they used the word Judeans as well anyway. So it wasn't necessarily Jews that was used. I think Jews was kind of firstly introduced into the King James version of the Bible. But you'll have to double check that. But I'm pretty sure that prior to that, it was Judeans. Even the Latin Vulgate uses Judeans.
I think they used the word H rather than a J, because we didn't actually have a letter J in the English language until the 17th or 18th century. But there are various versions of it. There's Judeos, Judeoi, and one of them, to translate it today, you would say Judean and Judahite are the two differences. Judahite would mean a descendant of Judah, whereas Judean would mean a citizen of the country of Judea. And obviously, if you're a citizen of Judea, it doesn't imply that you're descended from Judah. That also included the proselytes of the gate and the proselytes of justice, which were people from all different ethnicities that became Judeans and followed the religion, and they baptized them, basically, and they brought them into this Judean religion. They were proselytizing. They were trying to get people to join this religion, which is the opposite of what the Hebrew religion was. That was specifically only for the descendants of the Hebrews. Nobody else. That's who these promises were made to. So it's it all got messed up, the Hebrew religion, in the 500 years before Christ, basically.
Yeah, sure. I know Jesus didn't have anything positive to say about proselytes, did he?
No, he said that, what was it, they were children of hell? They made the proselytes into every bit of children of hell as they themselves?
He says you travel land and sea to make one proselyte, and by doing so you make them twice the child of hell than yourself. It was pretty strong words,
Pretty strong language, yeah.
Yeah, but it goes to show the extent to which they went to make proselytes. And you think, well, why to that extent? And it was clearly a money-driven, it became a money-driven orientated faith, similar to the Catholic Church, I would say.
Well, this is the thing.
Core power.
This is the criticism, isn't it? That there were aspects of the early church that were actually taken from bits to do with Judaism, such as proselytism, trying to reach out to other ethnicities, and also baptism itself. And this idea that baptism is an essential part of becoming a Christian, that was like a holdover from what these Jews were doing.
But yeah, I think that's where a lot of the modern day doctrines come in of being born again. So you're baptized, submerged under water, and you're reborn again through the association with kind of baptism and it's a spiritual baptism. I think that's how it's seen, isn't it? So it's not that you're born Son of God in that way, and through faith, kind of circumcised through faith, but it's open to anyone that just believes and is baptized and can be reborn in that way.
And if you look at the earliest Christian faith, they didn't have baptism. We know that because that was one of the criticisms that St. Augustine had when he came to Britain to Christianize the Anglo-Saxons, and the Welsh were already Christian, or the early Britons were already Christian. They had bishops, and their Christianity had been brought to them through St. John rather than through St. Paul. And they didn't follow baptism. Now, that was one of the criticisms that St. Augustine had of them, was that they weren't following this. So we know from that the first Christians did not follow this baptism tradition. But there's a lot of work on that Bill Fink's done over at christoginia.org, if people want to look that up, because, you know, it may come as quite a shock to hear that something so central as baptism, that there could be a question over it. Well, let's move into the main subject matter of today then, which is going to be dolmens and megaliths. And where we finished up the episode before last, we were talking about white people in China, particularly in the Tarim Basin and also in Korea. And the evidence that we have for white people being in China is abundant, really, just from these stone structures. And there's more evidence of white people being in Southeast Asia, mainly found in Korea, where over 200,000 megalithic structures have been recorded, with 90% of them being in South Korea, where they have the status of protected monuments. And these are exactly the same as the dolmens that we have in Britain.
Right, that was my question. I was going to ask. So same structure, same arrangement and things like that.
Oh, exactly. Three uprights with a big capstone on the top, and these ones were actually erected a couple of thousand years later than the ones that were erected in Europe. But it's hard to actually tell when these things were erected, because you can't tell how old the stone is or when it was when it was first erected, when it was first put into that position. But getting back to these ones in Korea, most of the stones used are absolutely massive, with the largest example found being 5.5 meters wide, 7.1 meters tall, and many weigh over 70 tons. I think the largest capstone in Britain is 80 tons, and that's on one of these dolmens that's actually collapsed. And these megaliths in Korea are exactly the same as the type found all over rural Britain, and we also find them in Iran, Lebanon, Israel, Japan, and India, with a small number in America as well. So, and these are not put up by these other peoples. They're put up by white people, and they're still standing today. And it's quite incredible when you think about it, because when you look at them, there's only a tiny point from those three uprights that is actually connected to the capstone, and yet the capstone remains there. And they believe that what they did was cover them with earth, and that they kept bodies within them. But I think maybe it's more likely that they didn't have earth over them. They were set up in the way that they are, and people stood on them, and they could address the crowd that was around them and be seen and talk to them.
I read some years back, I was of a different mindset then, but it might have some weight to it. But basically, there's a correlation between the placement of these megalith structures, and they all tend to be put on magnetic hotspots, that intersect across the world, and they have the strongest kind of magnetic attraction. And this is where that they found correlation of where they tended to build them on.
Well, I think what you're talking about there is dowsing, because people can douse lines, they can douse energy, and there's two different lines of energy, a male line and a female line, and they curve around, and where the two cross over, that's where you tend to find the either like dolmens or megalithic structures, but also churches.
Okay.
I'm trying to think. There's a book called The Sun and the Serpent that traces these lines all across Cornwall. And there's another book called The Dance of the Dragon, which traces these lines, which they call the Michael and Mary line, right the way from Skellig St. Michael in Ireland through the Mount of St. Michael in Cornwall, Mont Saint-Michel in France, and they keep on going, and they end up at what is called Har-Megiddo, which they think is where we get this word Armageddon from, which is this cave structure, I think it is, that's out there in Israel. So they trace this line, they doused right the way across from Ireland to this place, and you can plot it on the map, all these important points, and then you get ley lines that coincide with it as well, which is when you look at these points on a map, it seems as if there's a line that goes through them. And that's what that line is. It's energy that can be doused. And where these energy lines cross over, that's called a node. And that's where they put these churches. So, and these dolmens and megaliths. So that's, maybe they could understand this energy in the past. Maybe that's the sort of energy that you see when you see the starlings all swirl together, or when you see insects that all swirl together. Apparently they do that over these nodes as well, going up in a spiral.
Yeah, it's interesting. Either it's something they were conscious of, or it was just an inner feeling where they felt a stronger presence, you know, and they kind of felt naturally just pulled towards that. And it was just an unconscious action rather than a conscious, who knows? So I'm not sure if they could have measured it physically, could they?
No, but I mean, they may have doused it, they may have felt it. Another thing that you notice about these sites, they're always placed in a really beautiful natural landscape. They're beautiful, peaceful, calming places. And years ago, they would have been seen as religiously significant. And this is why when you find dolmens or standing stones, you'll also find a church nearby, because that was a religiously significant place. You would get the standing stone or the dolmen, then you would get the church, then you would get the village that would build up around the church. Then you would get the villagers trying to break down the stones to make them into building material. And then you would get other villagers that would take the stones, they would rescue them, as it were, and they would put them in the churchyard so that they couldn't be broken up. So in a lot of the churches in Wales, you'll find that there are standing stones in them, or you'll find that there's a church that's even built within a stone circle in some instances. There's one in St. David's. This is quite an interesting one. And St. David's, he was given birth to by St. Non. And St. Non was in a field in a thunderstorm right next to a stone circle. And when she gave birth to St. David, a holy spring of water sprung up right beside her. So there's a holy well there. And then you've got the stone circle, which you can still see. And in the middle of the stone circle is a chapel to St. David that was built. And in the middle of the chapel, you've got a Celtic cross that's all that's sort of left of it. So you've got a stone circle, a holy well, a Celtic cross, and you've got this legend that's built up around it, and you've got a saint that was actually born there. Yeah. All these traditions.
I guess one would kind of breed another as well, though, you know, in terms of once there's one landmark established, and you often get it will start to attract people of a certain mindset, and then it's easier to settle there. It adds momentum,
I think. Well, what you had there is that you ended up with next to this chapel, there was St. David's Cathedral that was built, which was called Minerva, and that was a very important cathedral. You could go there twice, and it was the equivalent of going on a pilgrimage to Rome. And then you had the city of St. David's that was built up around it. So you would start off with the stone circle, and then there was the holy well, and then there was the chapel, and then there was the cathedral, and then there was the city. And it was the main city in Wales for quite some time. And that's the pattern that follows, that you find the holy site. It's marked with a stone, or it could be marked because there's a healing well there. Because we used to believe that the powers of the waters that were coming up out of the earth, they could heal people. And there are cursing wells as well. There were wells that would bless you and heal you, and wells that you could curse people with. Yeah. And they're still on church property, cursing wells that are on church property. It's interesting stuff to look into if you're interested in British traditions. And I wonder whether they were similar in Korea. And I also wonder how many dolmens and megaliths there are in North Korea, because it tells us that 90% of them are in South Korea. But we know that in North Korea, they have a mythical history. They have a special cave that is tied in with Kim Jong-un. And they believe that he's from a godlike family that have this link with this special cave. And there's a holy mountain in North Korea as well. And where it's cut off from the rest of the world, we just don't know the details of it.
So then with 90% being in kind of South Korea, you'd also make a case that the in original inhabitants of Korea would have been white, or at least intermingled over time with other natives of a different race.
Well, I think so, because that's what we've seen with the mummies that were found in the Tarim Basin, which is fairly close to Xinjiang province. And what we know there is that there were Caucasians there from, I think it was 3000 BC to about 1000 BC or 1500 BC. And in 1500 BC, we end up seeing some of these Mongoloid types. And eventually it's all Mongoloid types that we find, and we don't find any more Caucasians. And what we find in Korea, these dolmens that were built there, that they were built around the time that we know these Caucasians were in the Tarim Basin, because we found their bodies. And the reason why we find their bodies today and they're preserved is because it's all salt flats there. So when they put the bodies in the ground, the salt leached all the moisture from them and it preserved them. So if we're looking for these bodies again around where the dolmens are, it's not on salt flats. So the bodies would have rotted away by now. But we can see from the structures that are built there that they are the same as the structures built in Britain. And we think that they were built at a later period, which ties in with the time that we know there were Caucasians in the Tarim Basin.
Yeah, makes sense. I would like to see look for different markers as well, not just structure, but if there were certain letters or runes or something. I don't know, that can just give the extra clinical bit of connection.
Yeah, I haven't found out whether there is any writing there, because I mean, when we have the dolmens in Britain, there's not any writing on them. What we do find is that there are spirals on them. There are spiral symbols. Okay. There are chevron patterns. There are holes or like cut marks that are on them. And L.A. Waddell said that these cut marks that are on these stones, their origin is in Mesopotamia. And he shows that there are these same cut marks that are on the clay-baked images that we talked about when we were talking about Mesopotamia. A lot of them have these cut marks on them. And he said that was the same image that was on these stones in Britain. We also have labyrinth symbols, but we don't actually have any writing that's on. Oh, yes, there is. And also he claimed in Scotland that there was Phoenician writing on a stone in Scotland, but that's questioned whether it was Phoenician or quite what this writing was. And then I think in the 4th and the 5th century AD, we find standing stones that have got Ogham writing on the side. And Ogham writing is just straight lines carved into the corner part of a stone. So whether it's three or four lines, and whether they're horizontal or whether they are at an angle, tells you what letter it represents. And we have these standing stones with this Ogham writing on, and we often find that on the front of the stone they'll be writing in Latin as well. So you've got two languages on these stones, but we don't find that until Roman times. So that's the stones that I'm aware of with writing in Britain, and I'm not aware that there's any in Korea.
I've just had a look, actually. They compared the two dolmens in South Korea and dolmens in, say, Cornwall, for example, and I mean they do look near identical in terms of structure and placement. I would say the only difference is the slight difference in rock, but that's just down to the geographical placement, isn't it, and what they can find.
Yeah, and you also think, well, how do they do these things? How do they lift that capstone? How do they lift an 70 ton capstone up in the air? I mean, I've wondered, maybe they dug a pit, and then maybe they put the three uprights into the pit, and then maybe they put the capstone on top, and then maybe they dug around it, and then it would be stood up. I mean, that's possibly a way of doing it, but we just don't know how they did it today. And what you need is three points, and then you can put the capstone on top. And I think there's another thing that people do where they put one stone on top of another. I don't know if you've seen this, and it looks like the stones are magnetized, but what they're actually doing there, they use three points. So long as they've got three points on a stone, they can put a stone of any size on top of it, pretty much. And I think it's the same principle that they used with these dolmens that people use today when they set these stones up. I forget what it's called. Magic stones, gravity-defying stones, magic glue, something like that they call it. Have you ever seen that?
I'm not sure, but I've heard some theories about sound levitation technology, but who knows?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, we probably had all different sorts of technology thousands of years ago that we've just forgotten how to do.
Yeah.
Probably did similar to what we have now. Getting back to these dolmens in Korea, I've got a quote here from the World History Encyclopedia on them. They say dolmens are simple structures made of monolithic stones erected during the late Neolithic period or the Korean Bronze Age, the first millennium BC. So that's 2,000 years later than the ones that are erected in Europe. In ancient Korea, they appear most often near villages, and the archaeological finds buried within them imply that they were constructed as tombs for elite members of the community. And the remains that they find are cremated, so they can't tell what ethnicity the people are. But we can see here that the villages were built up around them, the same as in Britain, villages were built up around the megaliths. The dolmen structures can take three different forms, and precise configurations differ depending on the region. The first type, more common in the north of the peninsula across the Han River, is the table or tacture form, where one large stone rests horizontally on two or more upright stones, often arranged in a square. The second type, known as paddock, has one large flat stone set on top of a mound of smaller stones. And that sounds more like a cairn type. The third type, seen more often in the south, has a single large stone laid flat above a small rectangular buried tomb, which is lined with stone slabs and usually measuring 2,000 by 30 centimetres. So that's a small one. Alternatively, the tomb may consist of a simple jar burial, perhaps for a child. The first type of dolmen most often occurs in isolation, while the others are sometimes found set in rows or groups. Outstanding examples of ancient Korean dolmens are the table-type structures on Gangwa Island, which date to 1000 BC in the Korean Bronze Age. Single standing stones, or menhirs, unrelated to a burial context and perhaps used as marker stones, are also found all across Korea. And when we look at what the Israelites used to do with those standing stones, they would paint them white, and then they would paint the words of the law on them. And of course, over time, that paint would disappear, and you just end up having the standing stone there. So I do wonder whether there was paint on some of these large standing stones that we have. While dolmens usually occur as a single isolated monument, there are cemeteries in the south which consist of 30 to 100 examples placed in close proximity, sometimes in a straight line. This would suggest that the individuals interred therein were part of the same elite class, perhaps too the same dynasty of rulers. Dolmen tombs typically contain the remains of a single individual whose status is revealed by the precious bronze goods within, and by the very fact that they had a tomb constructed which involved the intense labour of moving the dolmen stones over many kilometres from their source. The enormous size of the stones involved would also suggest that the communities that built them were more than just villages. Such was the manpower needed in moving the stones. And again, I'll just pause there. And I also think if they were using them as tombs, it was a way that they could point to something in the landscape and say, well, that's my ancestors that are in there. And in the ones in Britain, some of the ones in Britain, we think what they did is they put ossuaries in them. And what they would do is they would leave a body on a platform like they do in India, so that all the skin and the flesh would get picked off by birds. And then when they had the bones, they would fold the bones up, put them in a box, and then they would put them inside this dolmen, and then they would inside the tomb, and then they would put the stone back. So maybe that was similar to what they were doing here in Korea, that type of tomb. Did you want to say something there, Patriarch?
No, I was just going to go into what a ossuary was exactly. It's basically it's just a type of tomb, is it?
Yeah, it's when you have the bones. An ossuary box is a box full of the bones of a body, and they fold the bones up, so you can put bodies in much smaller spaces than.
But that's assuming coffins. That the body would already be decomposed, right?
Oh, yeah. You'd have to have it decomposed. And what they do in India is they put them on platforms up in the mountains, and the vultures pick all the flesh off. And then what you've got left behind is the bones.
So they chop it up you could just chop the body up into different pieces and then just leave it like that.
Oh, I don't think they chop it up. They just put the body there, and then once all the flesh has been taken off it, then they fold the bones up. They take the bones apart and put them in a box.
Oh, I see.
And in some places, they actually build things out of the bones, don't they? I mean, it looks quite macabre. You may have seen that, where they have...
Really? No.
Yeah, all buildings that are made out of bones and skulls and things. I think that's something to do with the Orthodox Church, but again, that has a very old...
Really?
Very old history, wow. Yeah. Yeah, I forget what the title of them are, but you can find them on Google Images. Excavations of the tombs under dolmens have revealed bronze goods such as daggers, swords, bells and mirrors, but also polished stone daggers and burnished pottery. Several tombs also contain jade or amazonite beads, some in the crescent shape, known as a gogok, which possibly originated in Siberia and represents new life. Gogok would appear in later ornamentation, notably on the golden crowns of the Silla Kingdom from 57 BC to 935 AD. One of the richest tombs is at Namsong Ri, containing more than 100 bronze artifacts, which, besides mirrors and daggers, include an axe, chisel, a lacquered birch bark scabbard, and tubular-shaped jade beads. It may be that some objects were those of a shaman, and there is evidence that shamans were also tribal chiefs in early Korea. And it'd be interesting to see what the pottery was like and what connections that has to other civilizations. Yeah. And this one was quite late, so this probably was the Mongoloid type, if you think 50 BC to 935 AD. But earlier ones than that, I'd like to know what their pottery was like.
Yeah, obviously, they would show more of a connection to ancient culture. I'm just thinking, what of Noah's three sons? It would have likely been Japheth that moved into those regions, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it could well have been. I mean, that could be where they get the term Japan from. But I'm also just thinking there, the corded ware culture or the pottery type that they had in Germany and Austria. And we know that the clothes that they wore, the people that made that pottery type, it was the same clothing that they had in the Tarim Basin, and there was a connection to the pottery there. So it may well be that it's the same type of pottery that they were using in these early tombs that they actually had in Austria, because we know that it was the same people that were in the Tarim Basin on the Pamir Plateau that we were talking about, the mummies of Urumqi. That's the connection there. One curiosity which historians and archaeologists have yet to solve is why the finds in the tombs vary and those with more precious bronze goods are actually the least impressive dolmens. Well, that could be because they're the oldest dolmens and the likelihood of them having more technical bronze goods wasn't, you know, there wasn't much likelihood of that. That's what it could be. You know, why it's the least impressive dolmens. Or it could be that the least impressive dolmens were actually not built by whites, but built by non-whites that were copying them. And they weren't so good at making the bronze goods. They weren't so good at technicalities.
Yeah.
That's
possible.
Another one.
I mean, like we said it before, didn't we, in a previous episode, that over time they lose the kind of the knowledge of how to maintain things.
Yeah,
so maybe it's a similar case here.
Could well be. The significance of the size of the capstone has also been debated amongst scholars, and whether that signifies the status of the buried individual within. Exactly how the stones were erected is an additional source of disagreement. And another issue is the great similarity between Korean and European dolmens. For example, at Karnak and Locmaricœur in France, without any evidence of contact between the two areas at the time of construction. And I would say there is evidence of connection. There is evidence of contact because, as we've been talking about in the Palmyre Plateau, we have all these Caucasian bodies, which is very, very close to Korea. And we have the you know, the same building style in Korea that we had in Gaul and in Britain at the time. You know, this oh, there was no evidence of contact. This is going only if you believe this modern idea that white people were only in Europe living in caves while there were these great Arabic civilizations in the Near East. You know, it's only if you believe people don't actually migrate and move about, and that white people would have been happy not moving anywhere and not exploring anywhere. I mean, it just seems logical to me that, yeah, there would be white people there. There'd be white people everywhere. That's what we do, is we explore and we colonize and we build. Always reaching for something more, aren't we?
Tend to expand. I think, I mean, that's one of the, that was the one of the first commands to Adam, wasn't it, really? To populate, or to, in some cases, they argue, repopulate the earth.
Go forth and multiply. And was that to Adam or was that to Noah?
To Adam, but he said to bring the earth under subjection, you know, to basically rule it. It was an authoritative kind of...
take dominion.
Authoritive.
Take dominion, that was it.
To have dominion, and it was to take it, bring it under control. It was a command, really. And, I mean, you don't really see whites in one particular race to have done that throughout the whole world.
Well, I would also suggest that the reason for that is whites don't want to dominate. Whites don't want to rule. It's not something we naturally want to do. So we would be the best placed people to do that, obviously, because it's not something we want to do. And if we don't take dominion, and if we're not... responsible for everything, it means that somebody else will come in and take dominion who does want to rule, and they won't be a suitable ruler, and they will oppress the people that they're ruling. And I think that's an issue. That's why it had to be put there. Take dominion. You need to be in charge. If you don't take charge, somebody else will, who will be far worse than you. It's always better the devil you know, isn't it?
True. Very true.
Just finishing up here, it is clear that these impressive but mysterious monuments will continue to pose puzzling questions, just as they no doubt have to the successive ancient cultures of Korea, who left them intact for posterity. And it's interesting stuff. I mean, most people are just unaware of that there are all these dolmens and megaliths in Korea, just the same as in Britain. But I think it's very persuasive evidence that there were white people there.
Yeah, strong case.
Moving on to the megaliths in Britain, who were the megalith builders in Britain, and what purpose did their stone structures serve? Although the common belief is that they were pagans, there is a wealth of evidence to show that they were the Hebrews and the Sethites of the Bible, and that Druidry was descended from patriarchal practices. You know that we had Druidry in Britain for about 2,000 years? Before Christ, that was the main religion.
Oh yeah, we touched on that. They may have been introduced or came about during the tin trade, right? They could have settled here.
Yeah, I mean, well, we've got into that before, and we'll get into some more of that in a minute. There are five main types of these stone structures that are found all over Britain: menhirs, which are single upright stones; cairns, piles of rocks, usually in a cone shape; dolmens, a stone slab on three or more uprights; cromlechs, a circle of stones, sometimes enclosing a dolmen or a barrow. So that's I think that's a Cornish word for a stone circle; and tumuli, mounds of earth and stones covering a burial chamber. These types of stone monuments do not just appear in Britain, but are found all over Europe, Central Asia, and the Middle East, marking out the routes that the Hebrews and the Sethites took on their various dispersions as they expanded across the earth. And the Bible makes clear reference to these structures in many places. And again, this is something that most people aren't aware of. As far as I'm aware, the Bible is the only book that actually makes reference to these structures being built. I mean, you would think that there might be references to it in Greek works or Latin works, but I haven't found any. And there literally is loads of them in the Bible. I'll go through some of them now. Genesis chapter 28, verse 18. And Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put for his pillow and set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it. So that's a men here that's being talked about there. Mm-hmm. Chapter 28, verse 22. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. So that's the men here again. Genesis chapter 31, verse 45. And Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar. Standing stone once again. Genesis chapter 31, verse 46. And Jacob said unto his brethren, gather stones. And they took stones, and they made an heap, and they did eat there upon the heap. So that's a cairn. Genesis chapter 35, verse 7. And he built there an altar and called the place El Bethel, because there God appeared unto him when he fled from the face of his brother. So what he's built there is a dolmen. That's what an altar is, isn't it? It's a stone on top of other stones. Mm-hmm. Genesis chapter 35, verse 14. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, even a pillar of stone. And he poured a drink offering thereon, and he poured oil thereon. And that's another men here. Exodus chapter 24, verse 4. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and rose up early in the morning, and builded an altar under the hill, and 12 pillars, according to the 12 tribes of Israel. So what we have there is another dolmen, and we have a stone circle that's been built around it.
Was the stone circle of Britain, did they have 12 initially? Or?
There are loads of different stone circles in Britain.
Right. So it's not the, I mean, because there's generally one which is really famous though, isn't it?
Well, we've got Stonehenge is our most famous one, but there's
Stonehenge, yeah.
There's Roll Rod Stones. I'm not sure. I mean, that's got arches on it. That's got capstones. Where normally when you have a stone circle, it's just a circle full of standing stones, without capstones on the top joining them up. Stonehenge is the only one that has capstones on it, and that has a smaller circle on the inside of it, and that's probably set up for an astronomical observatory. But what we see here is that there's stones that are set up as memorial stones and to remind people of events that happened. And what we have here is after Moses writing down the words of the Lord, he builds an altar and then puts 12 pillars around it. And this is in, obviously, in the land of Canaan. And we find that they're still there today. There are all these stone circles that are there. Exodus chapter 20, verse 25. And if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone. For if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. And again, as we pointed out, with these dolmens that we find, they don't have anything carved into them. They don't have words carved into them or anything like that. And they're not shaped. So they're made of unhewn stone, exactly as the instructions are given from God in the book of Exodus.
So that's what hewn stone means. It's basically a shaped stone.
Yeah, shaped or chiseled. So you just find natural stones that are used for these dolmens. Did you want to add anything to that?
Well, I was going to say that does add confluence, doesn't it? To add a connection to them in kind of opposite to what you'd think if they did have carvings or markers. The opposite is equally as true. The fact that all of them consistently don't have that kind of goes to show that, you know, especially as it was ordered here in Exodus, it was a part of a cultural thing to not do that.
Well, yeah, and when we look at things like that the Greeks did and the statuary that we find in the Near East, there's obviously two different ways of doing things, wasn't there? There was a people that made idols and and they had sacrifices to idols, and then there was a people that just put up stone circles and dolmens, and that was the way that they did things. And the people that put up the stone circles and the dolmens, that they were the Israelites. And yet people today will look at it and they'll think, oh, well, that's pagan, that is, because it's pre-Christian. Yeah, they are put up in pre-Christian times, but according to the Bible, there were, most of them are very likely put up by Hebrews. And there's more, as we'll see. Go on.
So would you say that there's a connection to Hebrews and Japan? Because previously I suggested Japheth. They wouldn't have been related to the customs of Hebrews.
Well, it could well be, because it was the same people, the Adamites. The Adamites were given the law. Noah was given the law. Noah obviously knew how to set up an altar, because he sets up an altar as soon as the ark's rested. He sets up an altar and there's a sweet savour before the Lord.
True.
So obviously his sons would have known how to put these altars up, and they would have known that they were not to use hewn stone.
Right. Yeah, I see. So there is that connection, in essence. I guess it was really the Israelites that were kind of given the Ten Commandments, and they were officially put under the law, weren't they? The first covenant, which is what kind of cemented them as a kind of a people.
Well, yeah, the question is, was this the first time that this law had been given? Or was it a tradition that was being reinforced here? And I would suggest that it was just a tradition that's being reinforced.
I would say so, because I mean that it's testament by the primitive nature of the rock, isn't it? You know, to just have it there without anything, it's almost like it hasn't got any cultural influence. It's just raw.
Yeah, and also because he's saying this is how an altar has to be built, and yet there had been lots of altars that have been built before that time. We know there had been. So the altars that have been built before that time, they had to have built in this way, otherwise they would have been unsacred. They wouldn't have been able to have been used, because what God says stands for all time. He's eternal. So what is being said here has to apply throughout time. It's just that it hadn't actually been written down anywhere. Perhaps it had been written down somewhere else and we don't have it in our canonical books.
I wonder, though, also why it was commanded to not hone the stone, otherwise it would become polluted. Perhaps if it was honed, it would lose some form of energy or some ability to, you know.
Could be.
I just wonder if that has anything to do with it. Because if they were placed on these landmarks, which were typically associated with, you know, high energy landmarks, then lack of hewn stone might have been able to, I don't know, interact with this energy better than hewed stone.
Perhaps it was that the stones had to be used how they had been created.
Possibly.
How God created them, rather than being altered by the hands of man in any way.
Yeah. It was nature worship. Potentially, if it was more pagan based, you know, outside of God, but unless they saw God as part of nature back then.
Well, we know that the pagans used to shape them, didn't they?
Because did they?
Yeah, I mean, that was the idolatry and shaping them, the statue of Dagon that gets collapsed.
That was part of the pagan culture. That was why it was more of an abomination, because they kind of, they gave it a face, gave it a persona, which were, and kind of, in essence, took it away from the creator.
Yeah, took it away from its original shape. Deuteronomy chapter 27, verses 1-5. And it shall be on the day when ye shall pass over Jordan unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, that thou shalt set thee up great stones, and plaster them with plaster, and thou shalt write upon them all the words of this law when thou art passed over, that thou mayest go in unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, a land that floweth with milk and honey, as the Lord God of thy fathers hath promised thee. And Moses with the elders of Israel commanded the people, saying, Keep all the commandments which I command you this day. Therefore it shall be, when ye be gone over Jordan, that ye shall set up these stones, which I command you this day, in Mount Ebal, and thou shalt plaster them with plaster. So they're being told to do this. They're being told to set up great stones wherever they are, once they've gone over the Jordan, and to paint the words of the law upon them, paint the Ten Commandments on them. Obviously, the paint would be gone, the plaster would be gone by now, and this was a way of getting around this commandment not to make hewn stone. They could use plaster instead.
Right.
Get the message across.
That's interesting.
1 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12, Then Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shen, and called the name of it Ebenezer, saying, Hitherto hath the Lord helped us. So we have a standing stone there that is a marker stone, a memorial stone rather. 2 Samuel chapter 18, verse 17, And they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit in the wood, and laid a very great heap of stones upon him, and all Israel fled, every one to his tent. So that was either a cairn that they had there, or a tumulus. So they could have built the stones around it and then put earth over it, or they could have just put a cairn there. But they cast him into a great pit in the wood, it says, and then they laid the stones upon him. So it could be either a tumulus or a cairn.
Mm-hmm.
2 Samuel chapter 18, verse 18. Now Absalom, in his lifetime, had taken and reared up for himself a pillar, which is in the king's dale. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name, and it is called unto this day Absalom's place. And we have that same tradition today, don't we? We have stones that are put up, and they're actually named after old kings. Or we have King Arthur's Bed or King Arthur's Row, that sort of thing. Wayland's Smithy is named after Wayland the Smith. But there are stones all over Britain that are named after people. So this same tradition there. Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 21. Set thee up waymarks, make thee high heaps, set thine heart towards the highway, even the way which thou wentest. Turn again, O Virgin of Israel, turn again to these thy cities. So what is being said there is that when they go on their travels, they have to put these stones as they go, as waymarks, so that the people following can recognize the people that were there. So they recognize these were my people. These standing stones and these dolmens and stone circles, they would not have been put up by any other people. So we should be following in this direction. That's
interesting, because the fact that command is even given is testament to the incentive that they had to spread, you know, to spread out and travel. You know, if they weren't kind of commanded or expected to do that, then that the command wouldn't have been given, would it? Why would they need to kind of communicate with each other in that way?
Well, and that's also in the book of Jeremiah. So it's like it's telling the Israelites what to do once they've been taken from their country. They're to go and set up waymarks as they leave, as they make their way to the new land in Europe. They are to set up waymarks so that people can follow them.
Yeah.
Turn again to these thy cities, the new cities. There's a new land that they were supposed to be placed into, was one of the prophecies. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 28. Remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set. And so again, we're not supposed to remove these stones, and most of them are still there. So we have followed the instruction. And boundary stones are often said to bring a curse upon anyone who moves them.
Wow.
And that's in Britain,
really
we have that.
Ingrained into their traditions and culture. And, you know, I guess it just connects the same people right back to them.
Yeah, I mean, we have this tradition in Britain that you should not remove the boundary stones. You'll be cursed if you remove a boundary stone. And here we have it in Proverbs chapter 2, verse 28. From these verses and many more, it can be seen that the tradition of erecting standing stones as monuments to people and events had a long history with the Hebrew peoples. Even today, we still have standing stones named after our kings and ancient deities, carrying on exactly the same customs as referred to above. The second to last instruction there, given by Jeremiah, was to the tribes of Israel when they were in captivity in 700 BC. Much later than the age in which the first stone monuments were created in Britain. He seems to be telling them to go in the direction of the previous dispersions that left at the time of Moses and before the flood towards Europe and India, where settlements had already been established.
Interesting. So although Jeremiah as a book comes directly after Isaiah, it's not necessarily written afterwards, is it?
No, I think, as it says there, Jared, some of the northern tribes had actually been dispersed from where they were. And when Jeremiah was writing his prophecies, he was directing them. Some of them were directed to the northern house of Israel, who were already in captivity by that time.
Right, I see.
And he ended up leaving and taking with him the princess, the daughter of the last king of Judah. And he took the princess, I think her name was Tiatefi, and he took her to Egypt, and then and he also took his scribe with him, who's called Baruch, and apparently they then left Egypt, made their way to Europe, I think to the Milesians, and then they came to Ireland, or their descendants came to Ireland. And that's when the Davidic line that actually came from Pharez through King David, that line then made its way to Ireland and married in with the line that came from Zarajudah, which was already in Europe. And so you ended up with the Davidic kings marrying into the Zarahite kings. And that's why the royalty today claimed that they go back to the house of David.
Did they actually claim that?
Yeah, Queen Elizabeth does.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
They claim to go back to there. And also, Jeremiah was known as Olam Fodla in Ireland.
Wow.
And the Hill of Tara has something to do with it. And also, that's when the stone, the Bethel stone that Jacob put his lady's head against when he saw the angels ascending and descending into the sky, that stone was the coronation stone that the kings of Judah were coronated on. And that stone apparently came with them to Ireland, and then it got taken from Ireland to Scotland, and the high kings of Scotland were crowned upon it. And then Edward I took it from Scotland to London, and all the kings of England were crowned upon it. And then about 50 years ago, it got taken back to Scotland. It actually got kidnapped and hijacked, and it was hidden for a while. And I believe it's now back up there in Scotland. But you can look at it on the coronation chair. Queen Elizabeth was coronated on it. And there's this big block of sandstone that's underneath the chair. And it's of the same type that is found in Palestine. And that was apparently the stone that Jacob's head was on, and it was carried over. But it was carried over by the prophet Jeremiah, who took the daughter of the last king of Judah. I think it might have been Zedekiah.
Okay.
And he took the daughter with him to Egypt, and then you can sort of follow it on from there.
Yeah. There's some people that try and claim, I don't know if it's true, maybe, but they try and claim the Queen Elizabeth is linked to the Prophet Muhammad. But in some ways, I think that's only testament to the fact that Muhammad may have been white all them years ago. Well, I think he was white, because his verses in the Quran or one of the books which boasts of how pale he was.
Well, also the Moors at that time were a lot whiter than they are now, and we can just tell that from the depictions of them, and you can see that they're white. And you got the Berbers over there that were white. This darkening has happened very, very recently, really, I think, with the intermixing between the black slaves and the Arabs. I mean, they were mixed before, I think, in, you know, sort of 2,000 years ago, but not as heavily mixed as they are now. There were a lot more white people around. By percentage, there were a lot more white people around than non-white thousands of years ago. We're only 11% of the global population now, and we would have been 50 or 60% before.
But I think Arabs tend to be typically darker skinned than someone such as an Iranian or someone in the Levant area. Typically, they tend to be darker.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm assuming there's been more mixing there.
Definitely, definitely. But we should leave that here for now, I think. So I'll say thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.